In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with dietitian, author, and nutrition and science educator, Holly Tiron Baxter from Team Bia Body. Holly and I speak about the benefits of a more moderate cut, recent research on how much training volume we really need for hypertrophy, the inspiration behind her recipes, and more. Get ready for a jam-packed episode. Also, in case you are listening to this before the 1st of September, we are running a 75-day challenge from September 1st until November 15th. This is not like some other extreme 75-day challenges. With our challenge, we want to build some wonderful foundations that will allow you to stay consistent over the holidays. We call it the 3T Challenge. We will be tracking our nutrition intake. You don't even need to aim for a specific target. We will be training daily, and by that we actually just mean daily movement, so even 8 to 10,000 steps a day or a 20-minute bodyweight workout. And we will be taking a daily time out, 3 minutes in stillness that can be in the form of breath work, meditation, or however else you like. If you want to join our 75-day 3T challenge, simply follow the link in the show notes. And lastly, if you enjoy this episode, please help us spread the message, take a screenshot, and share the episode on your social media or leave us a rating or review. Thank you so much. That would be very much appreciated. Now on to my conversation with Holly. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Holly Baxter. She is a dietitian, bikini competitor, and coach with 13 years experience inspiring women worldwide to embrace a healthy life of knowledge, wellness, and self-empowerment. Holly, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to speak with you.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, for anybody who's listening who might not know you, which is most definitely the minority of our listeners, but who might not know you, maybe you can give us a little bit of an intro into who you are, how you got to where you are today, what you do.
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start out where I'm from. So originally, like, born and raised in Australia in a little place called Tasmania. I guess moved to the USA, specifically Florida, in 2017. I have been here ever since. And I guess as far as how I got into the industry, oh my gosh, so many things. I guess I'll try and give you the cliff notes. But I was pretty sporty when I was growing up. I did a lot of athletics and basketball. And I always say my mom put us into basically every single type of sport and activity that you can imagine. Musical, like educational as well. We did all the things. And I think I really wanted to be involved in something to do with exercise, or at least nutrition and health. So because I grew up in Australia, there weren't really a lot of opportunities to pursue, you know, high end, like elite level sport as a female. At least there were plenty of opportunities for men to be footballers and things like that. But women was like, yeah, there isn't really a whole lot of options. So, you know, the next best thing is to be involved in like the academia, or the world of academia. So I ended up going into do a bachelor's of food science and nutrition. And then I finished that, felt like I knew nothing and I needed to keep learning and keep learning. So I went and did my master's in dietetics. I spent a little bit of time after my first year out of dietetics doing clinical dietetics or nutrition, and realized pretty quickly that that wasn't the space that I wanted to be in. It was just a really different clientele, different patients who weren't perhaps as like self-motivated, you know, to be healthy and strong and, you know, live an active life. So that was kind of when I dived into having my own clinical practice. So I did that for a couple of years in Australia. And then I guess moved into the online space only as recently as 2017 when I moved over here. So yeah, I guess during that journey, I somehow stumbled my way into competitive physique sports. I actually had no idea or concept of bodybuilding until probably age 23 or 24. So I'm 35 now, for anyone that's wondering. And it was just through clients that I was working with. So one of my clients at the time, I was coaching her to get to the Natural Olympia. So this is when I was living in Australia still, and the competition was being held in Dubai. And that was kind of the catalyst for me thinking about doing it, because I loved the idea of travel. I mean, Australians, we travel everywhere. And I was like, what a great opportunity to compete in, you know, a sport that I potentially could be good at. and, you know, see the world. So she's like, oh, well, you, first off, you've got to win a state show and you've got to win a national show and, you know, you've got to qualify. And I was like, all right, let's do it. So I think she gave me her bikini. It didn't fit me. It was like, you know, hanging down around my crotch. Like I look back at the pictures and I'm like, oh my God, was someone not helping me? But yeah, I eventually won the shows that I needed to qualify and competed for Australia. So from there, I think that was in 2015 or 2016. And I have done probably 50 shows or something like that since then for a couple of different federations, which has been interesting to kind of just observe, you know, the differences in like the appearance of each of the different categories and how the shows are run and the different costumes. And routine. So it's been quite a journey, but, you know, kind of going along in the background as all of that was happening, I'd kind of been building my businesses, growing and I guess learning. And now I guess I kind of sit in the middle as somebody that's very interested in the evidence-based approach. And we've actually recently published some studies, but then I also try and keep it easy enough to understand that the average person can kind of interpret potentially difficult topics in our area. So yeah, that's kind of what I do and how I got here.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a bit of a background. And I love what you said there at the end about kind of seeing yourself as a bridge between the science and the application and bringing it to people that might not necessarily want to read the studies, etc. And I also love your inspiration for stepping on stage. I'm from Germany, but I usually live in Colombia. I've lived in New Zealand for quite some time. I actually never made it to Tasmania, even though I lived in New Zealand for over 9 years. But I've traveled along the east coast of Australia. And so, yes, a beautiful country.
Oh, wow. Yeah. If you get to go one day, I'll put it on the bucket list. It's stunning.
I bet, absolutely. But yeah, before we started recording, we spoke a little bit about the fact that you're currently in prep. And I am really curious about maybe what you think is different, this prep in comparison to other preps, or maybe also what you have learned from one prep after to the other over the course of 50 preps.
Yeah, I've done a few. Look, I think this time around, it's actually the longest preparation that I've ever done, typically speaking. And again, there isn't a right or a wrong way per se. I think it really comes back down to, you know, an individual's schedule, their capacity to, you know, execute a certain amount of training and to implement all of the things that are necessary for the nutrition to bring it all together. But typically, I would do anywhere from 12 weeks to maybe 16 weeks for a prep. And again, that's kind of within the constraints of how much body fat do I need to lose. So of course, you know, as we go through different building phases, there have been some, you know, years where I've gained a lot more body fat in efforts to maximize muscle growth in an off season. So COVID, the year of 2020 was an example where I did that. I think I put on 30 pounds to like really go for it. So again, in that kind of context, coming back in for a show, you know, I would probably have taken the 16-week prep, so a little bit longer to kind of get there. But this year was completely different for me. So I have significantly more on my plate at the moment. So I went through a divorce a couple of years ago and had to basically start everything again from scratch, which has been so challenging, but also really rewarding, but just a lot of extra pressure. So, you know, with that in mind, I thought if I'm going to do this, I don't want to be cramming. I don't want to feel like, you know, the world is imploding as I'm trying to navigate multiple different business entities and prep and manage, you know, some pretty ugly, you know, personal situations that were happening. So I did 24 weeks. And over the course of that 24 weeks, I squeezed in two shows. So I think the shows were maybe at weeks 21 and week 24, roughly. So it was a lot slower. So my weekly rate of weight loss was probably somewhere in the measure of 0.3% of my body weight per week. Like I went and looked back at the average. Whereas normally when I set myself up for a fat loss phase or, you know, a client, it might actually be closer to like a modest or to an aggressive or within the constraints of what the evidence says is safe and efficacious. So yeah, when I looked at that, I was like, wow, this is such a slow prep. But It gave me the capacity to, number one, still show up for my team, for my staff, to deliver multiple different projects. You know, we've had multiple things kind of popping up in business, from a research review to a new training app, managing a brand new coaching team, writing books. So, you know, I still got to kind of do that and balance it a little bit with my preparation and also still have a bit of a social life. I think I've realized over the years how important that feeling of social connectedness is. And, you know, previously when I'd done preps, I would kind of become a bit of a hermit, you know, and it was almost necessary and essential. But I realized that that behavior, whilst it allowed me to show up and be the leanest on stage, you know, and be successful in the sport, I realized that it was having some pretty profound and significant negative impacts on my overall health and well-being. So again, this slower prep really allowed me to still go out and, you know, enjoy two nights out at a restaurant every single week, you know, still enjoy some wine, still enjoy cocktails, and at least be partially present. Obviously, the leaner you get towards, you know, stage or show day, I won't pretend to the people that it's easy. I mean, you've probably got plenty of listeners that have done shows themselves, so they know what I'm talking about. There's just this food noise that doesn't go away when you're probably 6 to 8 weeks out. It is rough. So even though that is still present and it's difficult to avoid, I think, again, having a little bit more time allowed me to, you know, still be present and show up and, you know, be engaged in conversation and not just be thinking about everything to do with food or scrutinizing a menu when we go out somewhere. Like, I could still talk and chat and I'm like, oh yeah, okay, right, let me get to this now. So I think that's probably the main difference that I can see. And then I guess my relationship with food in general, I think, has improved out of sight. You know, when I first got into bodybuilding, and I know we haven't really touched on this at all, but I struggled with an eating disorder for about 15 years. So several years ago, I kind of decided that I was done feeling this way. I don't want to have this relationship with myself anymore. I want to be happy. I want to look in the mirror regardless of what my body fat percentage is and know that I'm a good person, I'm loved, I'm cared about. It doesn't change my worth or my value. And I have been very intentional in directing, you know, my thoughts and behaviors as a consequence to be that person. So every year the prep has got a little bit easier and, you know, the off season gets a little bit less daunting. You know, the idea of being at a higher body fat has definitely simmered down. I used to get really anxious and, you know, kind of feel like a failure or lazy almost, or that I wouldn't be taken seriously. And I have done so much self-development in that regard. So yeah, I think that the whole prep, you know, the in-season and the off-season feels a lot more comfortable than it ever has. So yeah.
Beautiful. Well, what I really liked about your takeaway from this longer but more moderate prep, I guess, is also for clients that perhaps have a bit more to lose, but also that we want to teach that they can eat out, that they can travel and still make progress, as opposed to thinking they're on their diet, they now have to eat quote unquote clean, or they have to be super, super, super strict. As you know, obviously you have to be at the end of a prep or when you are going much more aggressively. And therefore what you said there about this more moderate approach allowing you to be more social, I think that that's so beautiful. And for anyone wanting to have a social life while dieting, I think that that's just a good reminder that it's probably worth taking a bit more time, but taking it a bit slower. And then on the other side, I think that's, again, so beautifully said about the scale doesn't define us, our body fat percentage doesn't define us, you know, our who we are at our core. That's really what we should be focusing on. And even if it takes work for all of us to acknowledge that. But yeah, some wonderful takeaways there. I wanted to ask you about, because you mentioned you're potentially, or you might already have started a research review, and you also mentioned a couple of studies. Maybe you can share a bit about that. That would interest me what they were about, the studies, or what the research review is about.
Yeah, so I guess the research review is, it's called Be a Brain. And so it kind of falls in suit with all of our other companies that we have, Be a Body and Be a Fit. They are our training application and our coaching team. So it kind of sounded right, it fit. But anyhow, each month we deliver a review of four different subjects. It might be something that we're just generally interested in about. We might write something from scratch, or we'll take recent, I guess some of them are not that recent, but interesting subjects, things that are really meaningful to exercise, nutrition, and health. And we'll break those down in an easy to understand way. So we tend to focus two of those papers on something that's a bit more exercise specific, and then two of the papers are, the remaining two are on a nutrition focus. So I guess that's what the research review is. And we've actually covered, I guess, some of our work. The two that I guess I've been involved in are very recent. But the first one was in regards to training volume. And I guess there is a bit of a, I guess a zealot culture, if you will, that kind of gets behind the idea that, you know, more is better. The more training volume you do, the better your growth adaptations are going to be. So I guess I've definitely heard a lot of people say that there is this linear increase. You know, you do more, you get better outcomes. So I guess the objective of this particular paper was to take a look at the breadth of our research that's available, and try to tease it apart a little bit more, get a better understanding about what these individual randomized control trials are finding, to review previous meta-analyses and recommendations on training volume. And I guess what we found was some of the key papers that have been used as evidence for supporting higher training volumes don't necessarily have outcomes that we agree with or that we think are plausible or viable. So what I mean by that is there were a couple of papers that have been included in the meta-analyses that show rates of muscle growth, specifically through B-mode ultrasound, which is one of the standards that we'd use in the research setting. We can also use things like MRI, but that's a lot more expensive. So most of the researchers will use B-mode ultrasound to measure muscle thickness, or CSA. And I guess their findings, their numbers were substantially higher, somewhere in the magnitude of 4 to 7 times greater than what the rest of the research is kind of indicating for similar training volumes. So, you know, we're not saying that there's anything, you know, sinister about those results, but we just thought it was interesting when the majority of the research on muscle growth adaptations in response to different training volumes suggest much lower rates of muscle growth. So just to give the reader or the audience a bit of an idea, 0.2 to 0.3 centimeters is about what we would typically see in terms of muscle thickness over an 8 to 12 week study intervention. So, you know, you think about what that might actually look like. And if you look at your little finger, I mean, it's only a centimeter. So we're talking a fraction of, you know, a centimeter here. So this particular lab was finding some results that were a little bit higher, somewhere in the measure of 0.6 to 0.7. So it's a large magnitude greater than all the other research. So we just wanted to exercise a little bit more caution in response to high training volumes. And I guess for all definitive purposes, if we're thinking about the types of studies that are looking at low versus high, you know, lower training volumes would probably be somewhere in the measure of, say, 10 to 20 sets per week on one particular muscle group. A moderate training volume might be somewhere between 20 and 30. And then high training volumes would be somewhere, you know, 30 up to, and recently there was a study that was published that had 52 working sets per muscle group per week by the final weeks of this particular study. So, you know, that would be considered high volume. And again, there have been conclusions made that high volume is better, but when you actually look at the data, there were no statistical differences between the moderate group and the high group. There were trends that might have indicated that, you know, had we had more time in the gym and maybe the study period was a little bit longer, that maybe it is moving in a greater direction. But, I mean, that's why we have statistical cutoffs. So, you know, there were a lot of social media influencers really yelling from the treetops that, you know, more volume is better, but you can't really make those conclusions when you look at the data. So, yeah, I guess we kind of take the approach that, you know, a moderate volume is probably good, And again, it differs depending on whether you're a beginner or whether you're an advanced lifter. Different training stimulus is going to be, effective. Or one training stimulus for a beginner might not necessarily be the same as what's necessary for somebody that is more advanced. So I guess that's kind of the crux of the volume training study. We just wanted to exercise a little bit more caution. And again, I'm thinking about this from a practical perspective because I still, write programs for people and, we're doing training programming for all of our clientele. And the last thing that you want to do is overprescribe and give them too much where, now they're not recovering. It's having other, unforeseen consequences in their personal life. You talked before about people, taking things to the extreme, like having that dichotomous relationship where there's no in between, so they're all in and it's really consuming, which can become unhealthy at a certain point. But moreover, just not necessarily having any greater advantage. I feel like there are diminishing returns. So, even if you were to increase your training volume by a considerable amount, it's not necessarily going to relate in a linear increase in your muscle growth. Like I said, a diminishing return. So we tend to exercise a little bit more caution because, there's not necessarily going to be the payoff that somebody is interested in. And then you're also greatly or significantly increasing your risk of injury when you start to train at those really high volumes. So I think until there is more evidence and we can get some replication of these studies, one of them is the Schoenfeld study, which I mentioned before had the 0.7 centimeters muscle growth. We're actually replicating that right now at the University of South Florida just to see if we can get the same kinds of results. And maybe, I don't know what we'll find. I guess we're not trying to be biased about it. I'm interested, but right now, all of the statements around training volume have really been geared towards this one lab. Yet it's almost like the rest of the research was just like thrown under the rug and everybody forgot about it. So, you have to look at the global, what the majority of the research is saying to kind of make these kind of statements. So yeah, that was one of the papers. And then the other one that we were looking at was training with different ranges of motion. So specifically looking at partial range of motion in the lengthened position and then partial range of motion in the shortened position and also full range of motion training. So again, I don't want to take up too much time talking about this one, but I guess to take away, if there's anything that we can say, I think right now there isn't good evidence to support the effectiveness of training in a lengthened muscle length position, and certainly not for all muscle groups. I think we need a lot more studies being done on different muscle groups and different exercises before we can really say with any amount of confidence that lengthened partials are, the best way to train. Right now, I think that the evidence is weak at best. We have a couple of studies that might indicate that in certain muscle groups, for instance, the calf would be one, but the rest of the research that's been done primarily on the rectus femoris doesn't necessarily make any strong claims to that. There's been some miscommunication as well, I think, with some of the influences of what these studies actually say. So I still include lengthened partials. I still include full range of motion training. As part of my programming, I think having a variety probably might be beneficial. There are some papers that have indicated that training in the lengthened muscle length position might offer some like distal hypertrophy. So if we're looking at the different regions within a muscle, there are a couple that might show in certain muscle groups that you'll get greater hypertrophy at the distal portion, but not the mid, not the proximal. So again, whilst this is still such a nuanced area of research and we don't really have a whole lot to go on, I like to include a variety. Ultimately, I think all of these pathways kind of lead to the same thing. It's like we're trying to fatigue a muscle. We're trying to get all of those motor units within a muscle to contract and to fatigue. And I think we can do that from so many different training techniques, whether it's time under tension, tempo training, whether it's through training in a lengthened position. You might get there a little bit faster because it's a more challenging way to train. You've got less crossover in the muscle fiber. So you can't lift as heavy, thus you fatigue faster if you're not modifying your training ranges. So yeah, I think that right now I'm still very open-minded in that area of research, but I still like to include a bit of everything to make sure that my training is balanced and fun and enjoyable.
That last point is actually so important. I think often undervalued that we should still be enjoying what we're doing. So if someone loves training in the low rep range, but the coach says, oh, you only have to train between 50 and 20 reps. I think those arguments become null void because still adherence or enjoyment and adherence go hand in hand. So that's a big factor to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the way that I like to train, it's changed significantly just with, you know, emerging information. But I've also realized, you know, if I want to continue to do this for a long time, and which, you know, I have a big part of why I move my body and I go to the gym anyways for health reasons, it used to just be aesthetic, you know, and again, there's a bit of an example of like my progression over the years. So, you know, I used to love doing powerlifting and I enjoyed strength training and I've done several powerlifting meets. Yes, it was fun and I appreciate those experiences and the types of training that I did so much. It was invaluable. It really taught me, oh, wow, I'm probably not loading up heavy enough on the lighter, you know, higher rep range training. But I also used to get a lot more, you know, sore and fatigued and under recovered. And I was like, you know what? I don't really like waking up being sore all the time. And, you know, if I'm going to do something, I'm going in 100%, you know, giving it my best because I want to do well. But when you're training with that intensity and that ferocity, you're just more susceptible to getting injuries and not feeling great. And I was like, you know what? I want to feel good. So I'm going to kind of make some modifications to, you know, how frequently I do strength training now, you know, and have a bit more of a balanced approach.
I love that. I love the point of wanting to train for several, you know, for another 50 years or so. And to the point of volume, I mean, even if whatever the outcome is going to be that we find when it comes to training volume as it pertains to hypertrophy, thinking about the stress that we're putting on our joints as well, on our tendons and all these other things, and how we're feeling the next day is a whole other thing. So I think I'll be very interested to see what in that study with Brad Schoenfeld comes out that you're conducting at the University of South Florida, was it, I believe?
Yeah,
very, very cool. And when it comes to including variety in training, I also love that because, I mean, things like box squats are also good, but that doesn't mean you should never squat to full depth. And
yeah,
I always like to hear this is good, this is bad, but there's so often an application for several things. And perhaps with the lengthened partials, you know, that might be a good tool for someone who's specifically looking at improving the look of their bicep in a particular
area
or something like that. But it might not be as relevant to someone who just wants to work out 3 times a week and gain a bit of muscle overall. Like, I don't know what the majority of your clients and with Bia Body is, but I could imagine that you also have a good amount of gen pop clients and or not just physical needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, when I think about my training programs, you know, I'll put those things in because sometimes there is a certain method or training technique that is more efficient. You know, I'm really time poor and, you know, I used to have maybe 90 minutes to 2 hours to just la la la, you know, scooch around the gym and not really be in a hurry. But I, you know, I'm not like that at the moment. I have about 60 minutes to get in and get out. So, you know, there are certainly more efficient ways that we can train. As an example, I think rest periods is a really great way to kind of help bring this conversation to the table. Previously, again, when I was doing powerlifting, I would, you know, rest 3 to 5 minutes, which is recommended for strength adaptations. It's not necessary for hypertrophy. You can rest much, much shorter and still kind of achieve the same training outcomes. We see that in plenty of research. So for me now, I rest probably for 30 to 60 seconds for most of my accessory lifts, or I'll implement, you know, strategies like rest pause or, I guess, myo rep sets and things where I can kind of get through quite a bit of volume in a really short period of time and not feel like I'm compromising my muscle growth. So it's a very efficient way to train. And I would argue lengthened partials might be the same. just from the perspective that if I don't modify my training load, so let's say I'm doing a leg extension, for instance, or a hamstring curl. I use lengthened partials quite a bit for a seated hamstring curl. I often will put maybe 100 to 110 pounds on the weight stack. And normally I might do, 15 to 20 repetitions with that load. I can potentially, doing a lengthened partial, because I'm not as strong in that position, I can get to failure, like true failure, much quicker. So, my session can move through a bit faster than if I'm trying to do lots of high reps and, lighter loads or things like that. So, again, I think there's utility in all of these different approaches. And again, I think you've got to think about the context and, what the client's goals are, because there's just a huge landscape for all of the different training modalities that have benefits. And again, one might be better suited to another.
I think that's a really great point. And so many people listening are totally feeling that, in the sense of they're pressed for time. They want to get a workout in within 60 minutes or so. So really, really great tip. I do want to talk or a little bit more about nutrition specifically. Well, when I first started following you many, many years ago, it was mostly through YouTube videos of delicious looking recipes. And my question there was, well, number one, where your inspiration came from. I assume it had to do with your evolution in terms of food and no longer wanting to restrict also. But then at the same time, how you balance that still so nicely with eating whole foods, because I also know you have several digestive limitations. I believe SIBO or some other digestive thing that also keeps flaring up with specific food, with stress and so on. So yeah, maybe you can share a little bit in that aspect.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first off, so I have IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. It's very frustrating. I haven't had SIBO, but I also haven't really been tested for that in a long time. So who knows? But anyway, there are a lot of really great diagnostic tools that exist, and maybe we can chat about that in a moment. But the inspiration for all of my recipe guides, as there are quite a few, have probably just come from, being out at a restaurant and absolutely loving their menu. Like, it all sounds really good. So I will often just try to replicate what I've ordered when I eat out, or something that I've seen on a menu that maybe I didn't order at the time because it was really calorically dense. So, it's almost like this internal challenge where I want to try and replicate that through, flavor, through mouthfeel, so that I can really enjoy it but not be as calorically dense. So I think that's probably where a lot of it stems from. It's just my experience in eating out a lot. But I guess I also, when I was young, I mean, I did a lot of cooking. My nan, actually, I remember spending many a weekend with her, and, I got excited because she'd come over when I was a little girl, and we would be making this thing this day, and she's like, oh, come and help me cook this thing another day. It was often just baked sweets, to be honest. So I think when I like cooking, I really enjoy, baked goods and sweets and treats. But, I've had to diversify. Obviously, you can't just live on that. But I think that's kind of where my love, it just brought back lots of fun memories. So, I did food science and nutrition in my undergrad. So there were, there's a lot of education around the technicalities of cooking and how to, make sure that food presents the best way possible through flavor, through texture. So I guess that's where my interest in food has come from, but I also couldn't stand vegetables. So up until like age 22, admittedly, even as I'd already gotten my dietetics qualification, you couldn't have paid me enough to eat a veggie. It was only because, and this is where I say the experience I've had with bodybuilding has brought lots of negative things, unfortunately, but it has also taught me a lot about healthy eating, which I may never have discovered had I not done bodybuilding. So, when I started doing my first rounds of competitions, all I wanted to do was explore the sweet things. And when Quest first brought out their first lot of protein bars, I think I had every single box and every single color, and I would try and, fit that into my diet, or as many of those as I could, because I had such a sweet tooth. And I think after a while, I just realized you can't keep eating this way. It's not satiating. It's not healthy. You need to find, some recipes that contain lots of veggies that you can still enjoy. So it was like, it's been a mission really since then. to make, you know, foods as healthy as I can, but as fun and flavorful as possible. So yeah, our recipe guides now are, you know, healthier burgers, pizzas, you name it, like it's in there. So yeah, and I'll just go online sometimes and just type in, I don't know, something or a genre in general and see what looks good, what looks appealing. And I figure if I like what it looks like, other people will too. So, you know, then it kind of is the kickstart or the catalyst for getting in the kitchen and just playing around with different foods and just profiles, I guess.
I love that. And yeah, I think anyone following you can also see on your stories that you love eating out. You love you, like that, the whole central experience of that. And I very much relate to that. I think that's often portrayed as like, oh, you only have to make your meals at home. But you're saying you're getting your inspiration when you are eating out or from nostalgic recipes and making them lighter or just more satiating, more healthful. Yeah, very, very great point. And I guess as it pertains to your IBS, it took you a while to get to the bottom of that. Is that correct? You mentioned some forms of testing. Maybe you want to share a bit of about that.
Yeah. Okay. So several years ago, this is back when I lived in Australia, I was actually misdiagnosed with celiac. So I went and had several different tests, which came back, I guess, positive. So I had villus atrophy. So I guess when you're testing for celiac, you'll go and I guess have a little scrape of your the lining of your stomach, and they can kind of pull it back or your intestine and have a look and see what's going on. And all the little villi that exist to help with nutrient absorption were flattened. So you can see them on a little picture, and it is basically indicative that there is inflammation going on, and it's contributed to through, you know, consumption of a wheat-based product. So I, for many years, acted as though I was celiac. You know, I had a gluten-free diet. So it wasn't until I moved to the US and we went and did some genetic testing, like a very comprehensive genetic test at a longevity clinic in Naples, Florida, which I believe still exists. And it came back that I only had one of the genes that would indicate that I was celiac. So it was kind of like a bit of an aha moment. And it kind of made sense to me, because there were instances where I knew I was doing such a great job about eliminating all gluten from my diet. And I was still having, you know, on and off flares, just pain, wind, just general distension. It looked like I'd be 6 months pregnant within a matter of, you know, a few hours having eaten. So I ended up going and having a hydrogen breath test. So there are several different, I guess, testing profiles that you can do to kind of identify maybe some intolerances or to detect various medical conditions. So they basically work by analyzing the composition of your breath. So the hydrogen breath test specifically tests for fructose intolerances, lactose intolerances, and it can also help with SIBO, though at the time I didn't have that done. But usually what will happen is once you've consumed like the solution that contains lactose or fructose, your body should be absorbing it normally. And if that's the case, it's absorbed in the small intestine. However, if you have something going on with your small intestine and your digestion, they're usually not absorbed. So they're poorly absorbed. They travel all the way down to the colon, where the gut microbiome or our bacteria ferment those, I guess, molecules. So if it's lactose or fructose, whatever it might be. And then the byproduct of that fermentation are different types of gases. So you'll produce hydrogen gases, methane gases, and then those gases are eventually absorbed back across our intestinal lumen, so through the colon into the bloodstream, where we then exhale them. So the breath test then measures the concentration of either the hydrogen and sometimes methane, depending on which test you get. And they'll do that in regular intervals over several hours. And I guess elevated levels of hydrogen or methane are indicative of malabsorption. So, yeah, I found out that I have several intolerances. The methane test also looks at different sugar alcohols. So I'm not sure if you or your audience are familiar with the FODMAP acronym, but it's fermentable oligosaccharides and disaccharides and polyols. polyols are, I guess, the sugar alcohols that we are finding more and more of in diet foods, which obviously as a competitor, I was like, heck yes, I'm going to eat more of these because they're sweet and they taste good and they got no calories. But little did I know, like they were one of the worst things for my gut. So unfortunately, even today, as I compete, I will have more of those in my diet just to kind of keep it palatable, help me stay consistent. But my GI usually is a little bit unhappy during, you know, the tail end of a prep when my calories are low. But anyhow, these tests can actually help to identify whether you have an intolerance to mannitol or sorbitol or xylitol, like any of the sweeteners that are often used in these products. So that was kind of the process for me, you know, recognizing and learning that I had IBS. And then from there on, it has just been very, very painful and slow process of realizing that I have a low tolerance to a lot of these things. So, you know, I think I used to just have this mentality. Perhaps I lived in denial for a while. I'm sure people can relate. I'd be like, no, I can tolerate it. I'll just have a little bit. You know, so I was out having garlic and onion, and I mean, to the day, I still will eat some of these things from time to time, but I am very aware of my decisions. And I know if I do, I'm going to be miserable for a good period of time after I've eaten them. So, you know, if we go out and I've been invited to a restaurant with friends and they've chosen like Mediterranean or Italian, I'm just like, oh my God, like everything is garlic and onion. So, you know, I'll weigh the consequences, but you know, it's been challenging because it's meant that I've had to eliminate a lot of the foods that I love. Like I love garlic, I love onion, and it is the foundation of condiments, sauces, like everything that tastes good typically has these FODMAPs. So it's been a little restricting, and I will say it probably hasn't helped in my recovery from my eating disorder, you know, years ago. Because I wanted to be able to bring things back in, reintroduce them, expose myself to them again so that I could bring them back down off the pedestal that I put them up on, which was contributing to, you know, a really unhealthy and dysfunctional relationship with a lot of foods. But now, you know, my decisions for saying no really relate back to, you know, I've got IBS. Do you want to feel like garbage for the next few hours or not? And I've gotten substantially better at just being adherent to a low FODMAP diet. And consequently, all of my books now are all basically low FODMAP. So anybody that struggles with digestive issues, and again, that extends from diarrhea, constipation, bloating, wind, just pain in general. Yeah, all of the recipes have that in mind, but I'll also let people know, hey, this is going to be slightly higher in FODMAP or omit this ingredient, you know, if you do have IBS. So yeah.
Some very, very good points. Firstly, I like that you did not just stay satisfied with only having one diagnosis, even though you thought, oh, that's probably not right. I think that's an important message for people because we often put too much value into one physician's word. And secondly, I think what you're saying about just making a conscious decision about the consequences is such a good point because, I mean, the same thing applies to if you're in a dieting phase and you're consciously choosing to eat more on a particular day for whatever reason it might be, that is absolutely fine. Like enjoy that meal, enjoy that food, and then go forward and be like, I consciously chose. I cannot, like the next day, you shouldn't feel guilty about that choice. If it's an impulsive decision, that's different. Or if you're getting peer pressured or whatever, but if you're really consciously choosing, I think that that's a very good point. And just in general, also when it comes to the sweeteners, great to know that you can actually test for all the different kinds because sometimes you think, oh, all the sweeteners bloat me, but you might be totally fine with aspartame, but maybe not with sucralose or, you know, whatever it is. So yeah, very, very good points. And yeah, I want to make sure I'm respecting your time, but I do have one last question, which kind of lines up nicely with what you said at the end there as well. And I can imagine it to be quite challenging from a mindset perspective as well, or body image perspective as well, just knowing or going through all the different phases of building phase, cutting, and like internalizing over time that it's perfectly fine not to be super stage lean all year round. Yeah, how do you personally deal with that? But also maybe if you have any coaching points for for your clients or so that want to be lean all year round, which is, yeah, a very difficult thing and not a healthy thing to be.
Yeah, gosh, there are so many things that we could talk about here. I think first and foremost, education like springs to mind to me. I think when I take myself back to like the younger version of Holly, there were so many things, even, getting a degree in nutrition and food science, and then also having a master's in dietetics that I and we were simply not taught about. So just typically weight fluctuations, like there are so many variables that influence weight on the scale. And again, so many of us, are reactive to that number. And when we start to kind of look at all of those influences from your sodium levels, from your fiber levels to the fiber type, insoluble versus soluble, and then looking at our training intensity and the combination of exercise that we're doing, to what else? Your menstrual cycle. There are so many things that can cause your weight to move up and down on the scale that have absolutely nothing to do with body fat. So, what has been really eye-opening for me, I think, over the years as my coaching has evolved and as I've continued to, learn and grow my own intellect, I really started to see, wow, there are so many things that I used to react to in terms of my scale weight that were completely unnecessary. I might have one week made certain dishes that had a certain amount of sodium, and my average sodium might have been, I don't know, 4,000 milligrams per day. And then the very next week, I would, change my foods around a little bit, and I'd have a different, sauce or seasoning, or I hadn't eaten out. So my sodium would drop down, by an appreciable amount. And again, nothing that you should be trying to manipulate. I think just being aware of its influence. And, I'd see the weight drop and I'd be like having a party and celebrating when reality was I probably hadn't lost body fat that week. It was simply a response to me changing around some foods, and thus now my total body water levels have come down a bit. I never used to track my dietary fiber, and we now know that even adjustment or a tweak from one week to the next of, say, 5 grams, that will influence what the scale says. So it doesn't necessarily mean for me or the clients that I'm working with, or even anyone listening, that you should be trying to be a stickler about hitting the same sodium every week or having to hit exactly the same number of grams of fiber. I think it's really important to have flexibility with your food choices, as it allows you to be adherent, number one, but then, continue to progress towards your goals. But just recognize that, oh, wow, this last week I have made some pretty big changes in those two variables. How is that influencing, my weight on the scale? And also, until I started reading more research about the influence of inflammation, that the acute inflammatory response to resistance training, I didn't understand or realize how much my body weight would shift in the positive direction by training really hard, which, in my building phases, oh my God, like the training was grueling. I was walking around like a watermelon. But what I like when I first started, I would see, a 3 pound weight increase, in the first week of like a new training program that was intentionally geared towards building muscle. And I would have a meltdown because I was like, oh my God, I put on so much body fat. When the reality was, it was just inflammation due to new training stimulus or greater training volume. And then if you're trying to, balance that with some cardio as well, if you introduce a new modality of exercise, something that your body's not used to, there's going to be a period of adaptation where you've got to get used to it. But the initial response is it's a stress response, it's inflammation. So I can't tell you the number of clients that I've worked with, and maybe you were the same, where somebody's started, fat loss goal, and it could be for health reasons, could be for performance reasons. There's so many reasons why we might intentionally try to lose body fat, but their weight on the scale does not change. And, they'll check in and they're like, oh, I've done so terribly. I haven't lost any weight. But then I'll say, look at the increase in your volume from just the last 2 or 3 weeks. It's like a 40% increase. You've never trained like this before. You've never been this specific with your training before. By the way, not to mention, look how well you did with your fiber. Your fiber went from here to here, which is what I recommended. All of those things are going to make it look like you've gained a lot of weight, but it's not actually bad weight. I don't think any weight really is bad unless it's contributing meaningfully to like negative health. So again, kind of taking it back to education, I think understanding how our bodies work is really helpful, which is, the benefit of having a great coach. But beyond just the education stuff and normalizing weight fluctuations, I think just, practicing your ability to be confident in yourself. And I know that's really hard to do, but if you are tired of feeling upset about, seeing changes to your body composition, then I think we have to be really intentional about putting ourselves in the pathway of messaging and content and information that will support ourselves through a build. For me, when I first started, I remember I had to kind of get rid of a lot of social media because it was always the comparison game. And the people that I followed just happened to always be stage lean, or someone that I followed was lean. And I'd always get like that FOMO, like, oh, I want to diet again. So I had to tune out from all of that because I was like, if I keep trying to diet, I'm never going to get to where I want to go. I'm never going to build muscle. You cannot do that effectively if you're chasing your leanness year round. So recognizing the purposes, I think, of the different stages. There's an on season, for me at least, with competitions, and then there's my building season. And I know, there's metabolic benefits, there's health benefits from having more muscle. There are social benefits in terms of being able to go out and enjoy a wider variety of food once you've built the muscle, because that muscle tissue is so much more energetically demanding, than having low lean tissue or low muscle mass. So, yes, there are certain sacrifices that you make short term to maybe, having to get a new wardrobe or, see yourself in a larger body, but it doesn't and is not a reflection of you. You said it before as well. The scale does not get to dictate, who you are as a person or your value or your worth. You can still be a very hardworking individual. You can still, be all of the things. Your how you look on the surface doesn't necessarily have to influence, any of that. So, I think just recognizing the benefits of going through those distinct phases, and allowing yourself to be at a higher body fat, and adjust your expectations around what you're going to look like was really important, at least in my experience, and a lot of the clients that we work with too. And then I guess maybe thinking about, the motivations for exercise. It's always been about aesthetic, or it had been about aesthetic for me for a long time. And I think as soon as I started to train more for health reasons, so, instead of getting or forcing myself to move and to train because I knew it was going to, increase my muscle or help me lose body fat, there would be days where I would say, you know what, you've been pretty sedentary the last few days. I think this would be good for your health if you move. So rather than going into the gym or getting outside and going for like a high intensity run or something, or a really grueling training session, I'd still show up. But I'm like, you know what? This is just good for your health and your mind. So I started to shift that narrative to, moving for health, not just, the aesthetics. And it was refreshing. I think it allowed me to train, at a lower intensity sometimes, and give myself a bit more grace and compassion. Whereas previously it was, so motivated and so laser focused on this one thing. But, we can move our bodies for all kinds of reasons and performance as well. There's nothing better than going into the gym and, you might be at a higher body fat percentage, but when you hit a PR for like an exercise, like the feeling of like happiness that that brings and like accomplishment and empowerment, it's really exciting and it feels really good. So I think, broadening the reasons why we actually train is really helpful.
What a wonderful reminder. And yeah, just in general, thank you so much for your time, Holly. Honestly, this has been so insightful, and I truly appreciate you educating us, but also sharing so personally. That's really not always a given when you speak with people in the more evidence base space. So thank you truly. I very much appreciate you taking the time. And of course, I will link all your handles, your social media, the handle to Be a Body, Be a Brain, etc. in the show notes. So people, please go and check it out, and make sure you follow Holly for all her amazing content.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Awesome. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Holly Tiarn Baxter. Thank you so much for tuning in. And one more thing before you go, if you are looking for a premium supplement, our partner at Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. Feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.